Welcome, everybody. We're very happy today to have Guy Verhofstadt, who is the Belgian Prime Minister, to talk about his new book, which I should therefore show you. Some of you, I think, may have copies, The United States of Europe, which is very much about where we go from here after the convention and the constitutional treaty. Guy Verhofstadt is a Flemish liberal who has made a career, very successful career, in Belgian politics. Belgium, one of the original members of the European community, always with a very strong interest in European integration, partly, I think the Prime Minister might agree, because it has rather large neighbours and it wishes to ensure that integration does not trample over the interests of smaller countries. Three large neighbours, France, Germany, and Britain. He's going to introduce our discussions for about 20 minutes, and then Quentin Peel from the Financial Times will offer some comments, and then we'll open it to a more general discussion from the floor. Quentin, whom I hope many of you already read, is now Associate Editor of the Financial Times. He has previously been the head of the Brussels Bureau, thus writing on the European Community. He's also served in Moscow, and he's been their foreign affairs editor, so knows a great deal about the broader European issues. But first, we're going to hear from the Prime Minister, and I should, of course, as you get up, say one other thing, which is this pamphlet has been produced jointly with the Federal Trust, the oldest think tank in Britain working on European issues, and the Federal Trust has contributed to the publication of this in English. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank the London School of Economics for the opportunity that we have here in this theater to discuss about the book, The United States of Europe. I want also to thank the Federal Trust, who has had published the book in English, and also to thank Professor Stéphane Collignon, who have made a very beautiful introduction for the book, and with Professor here at the London School of Economics. So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Peel, ladies and gentlemen, today, 50 years after the European Community set out to secure peace, stability, and prosperity, I think that we can only conclude that the European Union has delivered. The European integration is, I think, a real success story. People born in a free Western Europe after 1945 were, in fact, the first for many centuries not to have experienced war or dictatorship. And as the Union has enlarged, the area of stability and democracy in Europe has grown along with it, first taking in Greece, Spain and Portugal, and then the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, which barely 15 years ago were still in the grip of communism. I think that we can say that Europe has been a key factor that turned poor dictatorships into prosperous democracies. So, without hesitation, we can say that the European Union was the most successful political project of the 20th century. But at the same time, European integration has also prompted economic growth. And I give one example, when Ireland acceded to the Union in 1973, it was in fact the poorest country in the whole of Western Europe. And now today, it is one of the five richest countries in the world. Other example, the Spanish economic miracle, European integration has proven to be our magic formula for enhancing regional cohesion and closing gaps, I think, in prosperity. So European integration has been the most important social and economic project of the past 50 years as well, I think. In fact, European construction has been so successful that it has also inspired similar projects all over the world. The ASEAN in Southeast Asia, for example, the African Union and Mercosur in South America. And throughout the world, the European Union today is being studied as an example to follow. And 50 years into its history, I think that we can say that the Union still exerts a tremendous appeal. And this is reflected in the growing, I should say, growing waiting list of candidate member states for the European Union. So I think that we can say after more than 50 years that we have every reason to be proud. And after all, we have already achieved a great deal. We have created a single market. We have dismantled internal borders. We have a European Central Bank. We have a common European currency. And since the Treaty of Amsterdam, we have been working on a common foreign policy with its high representative, Mr. Solana, who is doing, I think, an excellent job. We have Schengen. We have Europol. We have Eurojust. And moreover, we have started working on a European defense capability with our own European strategic unit. So on this road of European integration, the Constitution seemed to be, I should say, a logical further step. And that view was shared, I think, by the vast majority of the European population. Every Eurobarometer opinion polls has shown that a clear majority of Europeans backs further integration. So the key question of my speech today is the question, what happened with the French and the Dutch no against the European Constitution? Why is Europe in crisis today? And why has belief of so many people in Europe given way to cynicism and even apathy? So people fear. They fear for their jobs. They are frightened about losing their level of prosperity. And they are afraid not only that new economies with their cheap manpower and substandard social security will outcompete our companies, but also that our companies will delocalize. And we know that these fears are in fact not without foundation. The economic gap between European Union and the US is growing. And the growth gap with China, India, and Southeast Asia is even wider and looks set to grow even further in the near future. In short, I think that people feel that globalization is in fact changing the face of the planet extremely fast. And they sense that a battle with naturally potential winners and losers is unfolding and that we will ultimately end up amongst the losers. And besides this economic and social uneasiness, people fear the increase also of international organized crime, of drugs trafficking, and of course of terrorism. And how is Europe responding to all these developments? Divided. Europe is divided, as, to give one example, the war in Iraq made abundantly clear. And in that instance, the differences were so serious that the European Council didn't even try and reach a common viewpoint. I remember me that very well. It was a meeting of the European Council in Barcelona, and we put the point on the table, and I think the discussion had taken 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes, on Iraq. And which is unfortunate because the lack of consensus effectively weakened Europe in the international political arena. And the fact that Europe reacts divided makes citizens doubt about whether the Union is still capable of delivering, if Europe is still a force for the future. And these doubts about Europe makes that people fall back to the level with which they are most familiar. And that is naturally the nation state. And there are plenty of politicians who are in fact delighted to follow such reasoning. Yet everyone knows in fact that this is not a solution. Compared with the United States, the only superpower, and China, Japan and India, which are on their way to become future superpowers, all European countries are in fact small countries. I'm always saying some know it, others are still thinking about it. So these new superpowers won't just be economic heavyweights. It's very clear that they shall become also political and military powerhouses in the near future. And to these developments, there are in fact two ways of responding to these global developments, to the divisions in Europe and to the fears and doubts voiced by citizens. The first option is to reconcile ourselves to the situation. We could resign ourselves to the fact that a European Union of 25 member states simply is in fact incapable of reaching a consensus on a shared political project. And this option would effectively bury the political project of European construction. It would mean choosing to relegate Europe to what I could call a big free trade area, in line with Charles de Gaulle's notion of l'Europe des nations. And I am aware that this is the choice favored by some political leaders, and maybe also, and certainly so, by a part of the public. But I'm not convinced, however, I'm not convinced that this is the choice favored by the majority of the European citizens, not even those who voted against the Constitution. On the contrary, I think that people know that one country of 10 or 60 million people will never be able to hold its own against countries with over a billion inhabitants. And people here in Europe know their future is in fact inside, in the European Union, but in a union capable of delivering solutions just as it has done in fact in the past. And it is why, in my opinion, in my option, I'm not opting for less Europe, but in fact for more Europe, for a stronger Europe, and for a political Europe. At least we should dare to have a debate about that. I think we should at least leave what I call the omerta, the silence of today about the future of the European Union. It is to stimulate that debate that I have chosen the provocative title of the United States of Europe, and I can say that my provocation seems to work the last weeks and the last months. But there is also another reason for this title. I'm convinced that we can learn something out of the history of the other United States, the United States of America. For nearly a century after the foundation of the USA, in many respects, and in spite of the Constitution, the country was governed as what I call a confederation. A confederation in which the individual state had far greater power than the federal level, than the federal government. And the federal government was especially weak during that initial period. It had hardly any ministries or departments. The president at that time had no staff. And in fact, the biggest federal department in the 19th century in the United States of America was the Postal Service. So the turning point for federal America was the Civil War, after which the country's federal government gradually developed. And as individual states proved to be, in fact, too small for certain business initiatives, the opening up of the Far West, the development also of the country's railways, and the advent of heavy industry played just as critical a role in the government's development as the Constitution itself. So back in the 1950s, 17% of America's GDP went to the federal government. And today the figure is somewhere in the region of 20%. But in 1929, the year of the great stock market crash, the federal government received just 1% of America's GDP, which is exactly what the European Union receives today after the agreement on the financial perspectives. So whenever the USA has been faced with a major economic or political challenge, historically it has always opted for one thing, for more cooperation and a stronger federal approach. And in every instance, that has proved to be the right choice. And I'm convinced that we in Europe now have to make the same choice, especially bearing in mind the tremendous economic challenges facing us today. And it is the reason why I'm convinced that just like in the USA, we urgently need a proper economic strategy. What we need is to draw up shared social economic policies, and I think it is vital to go beyond what we call the open method of coordination currently used in the Lisbon strategy of today. National reforms are good, but simply will not do. What we need is to learn real lessons from our failures and boost economic governance inside the European Union. And when I'm talking about economic governance, I'm not talking about harmonization here. I'm talking about convergence. Convergence between different rules, including those governing fiscal and social security matters. However, I think that this new phase of European integration can't merely consist of a common socio-economic strategy. We also need a single European area of justice and security. We need also to better coordinate our efforts at tackling crime, terrorism, and illegal immigration. And this new Europe should also have a genuine common foreign policy. And this would prevent the Union from being divided as it was over going to war in Iraq. It would ensure that we stay united on important subjects such as Iran or the Middle East process. And it would avoid the indecision we saw when there was a civil war in the former Yugoslavia, a war fought on our own continent. And clearly, in future, we will need a European defense, a European army, not just on paper like today, but a force generally capable of operating in the field, including beyond European borders, and not to compete with the Atlantic Alliance, but as the European pillar of the Alliance, to enforce, in fact, the Alliance. Let that be very clear. So the philosophy behind all these proposals, economically, politically, military, is always the same. I'm utterly convinced that the citizens' doubts and uncertainty, as for example reflected in the two referendums, actually constitute a plea for more Europe, for a stronger Europe, and not for less Europe. And I'm advocating a more powerful Europe, a more also closely integrated Europe, a strong Europe that embraces a common economic strategy, a Europe that takes a joint stance against crime, drugs, terrorism, and a Europe that speaks abroad with one voice. In short, I'm advocating a United States of Europe. I hope that all the EU member states will want to belong to it. But I know that it's highly unlikely on the short term. The two contrasting visions of l'Europe des Nations of Charles de Gaulle on the one hand and a political union on the other are simply too far apart. So I think both visions need to be able to coexist. To coexist in what I call a kind of compromise. And I know with that vision, based on that vision, Europe would comprise two concentric circles, a political core, or United States of Europe, based at least around the Eurozone, surrounded by a confederation of countries. I call it the Organization of European States. And what is the best way to continue to spread the stability and prosperity, and at the same time also to be inclusive, such an organization of European states? And it has always been the Union's major strength, and this strength must not be allowed to become a weakness today. European Union enlargement must not bring the Union to a halt. And that's why I'm arguing in favor of a Europe made up of two concentric circles, a potential compromise, I should say, a potential compromise between the two strongest visions on the future of Europe. And also giving an answer to that antagonism that exists today between the deepening of the European Union and the enlargement of the European Union. Naturally, the political core must never oppose any form of broader cooperation. Any member state, I repeat, any member state, old or new, that wishes to join the core group should be able to do so. And the sole precondition for joining should be a willingness to help press ahead with the overall political project. So, ladies and gentlemen, the chair, I would like to end by quoting a speech of Winston Churchill, a speech delivered after learning the lessons of World War II. And Churchill said, and I quote, "We must recreate the European family in a regional structure called, it may be, the United States of Europe. If at first all the states of Europe are not willing or able to join the Union, we must nevertheless proceed to assemble and combine those who will and those who can. And the salvation of the common people of every race and of every land from war or servitude must be established on solid foundations and must be guarded by the readiness of all men and all women to die rather than to submit to tyranny. And therefore, I say to you, let Europe arise." End of his quote. So, thank you for your attention. Thank you.
And now an Anglo-Saxon response, Quentin.
Thank you very much, William, and thank you, Prime Minister. I'm not sure how much of an Anglo-Saxon response this will be, or how recognisably Anglo-Saxon, but let me do my best. I wanted to start, Prime Minister, if this is not too sycophantic, by paying tribute to you for producing this, what I would describe as manifesto for a United States of Europe. Congratulations first for relaunching the debate. I detect perhaps an element of frustration. This was a debate, after all, that you launched with the Laeken Declaration, that led to the Constitutional Convention, that was an extraordinary process and an extraordinary debate in that convention, and then it's all got frustrated by the French and Dutch no votes. And I think you're not the only one to feel frustrated, but you had a certain degree of personal ownership thanks to launching it at Laeken. The second reason for congratulating you is that, as you say in your booklet, you like to call a spade a spade. Thank God. You're absolutely straight. You want the European Commission to be a European government. You say we need a European army. You don't use weasel words like rapid reaction force to disguise what it may be, or even not very rapid reaction force. You want Javier Solana to be called a foreign minister and not a high representative for something or other. Thank God, in journalism it is so dreadful always having to use these weasel words. And finally, you say it's a United States of Europe that you want. Great. You are a federalist. But I don't think you are a blind federalist, although your counterpart in this country might fear that. You are actually a federalist who is looking at the problems. And that's very good. Secondly, about your manifesto, it's good and short. It's compact and it's readable. I commend it to you all. If only the European Constitutional Treaty had been as short and readable. You focus on the heart of the matter. Europe is divided between believers and non-believers, between Europe des Nations. I like the way you allied Europe des Nations with the idea of a free trade area, because straight away you put the Gaullists in bed with the Brits. And actually, they do spend an awful lot of time in bed together, even though they convince each other that they detest each other. The Brits and the French both are quite hesitant about the sort of Europe that you're presenting. So there is a real problem because there is a very clear division of view. So at the conclusion, what I'm going to ask, you propose a core Europe to go forwards towards this United States. Is that the right answer? And secondly, how the hell are we going to get there? I'll come back to that. First, and there'd be no point of me standing here if I wasn't going to be somewhat critical, I want to criticise a little bit your analysis. Actually, having heard your speech, this may sound a little bit off-key, because I found your book more pessimistic than I would be. You started off today very optimistic about what the European Union has achieved. But I think your interpretation of where we are today and why we're there is, to me, slightly too pessimistic. Europe has been through an extraordinary process of change in the last 20 years, since, let's take 1985, the Single European Act, the launch of the internal market, and then the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then Maastricht and the launch of the single currency. And then, during this period, three huge enlargements, Spain and Portugal in 85, then the Nordic countries and Austria, and finally the biggest enlargement of all with the new member states in 2004. And on top of all that, perhaps not so popularly perceived by the man and woman in the street, common foreign policy, justice and home affairs, more real to ordinary people, and a common defence policy. These are enormous changes we've been through in 20 years. And I think the most important of all, and we're too prone to forget it, was probably the launch of the single market. It's the thing that gets through to ordinary people most, that there's been too much harmonisation involved, too many rules and regulations, as you say in your book, about how you make French cheese or how you should make German beer or those sort of things, which were unnecessary. But that's what made people rather irritated. And coming on top of the single market, the free movement of labour suddenly becoming a reality with European enlargement. Free movement of labour has always been there, but we never used it. But suddenly we've got 10 new member states with a much lower per capita income, and they want to travel. And that's caused a backlash too, which was undoubtedly part of the backlash in the French referendum, and a little bit in the Dutch perhaps too. So all of these things, I don't think we are in a political crisis. I think we're suffering from chronic indigestion, and that's what we need to deal with. So all of that change in Europe and out there in the world, globalisation, as you underline so well, it's certainly in perception people feel it as a threat. It's funny, sometimes, and the Financial Times might almost be called the newspaper of globalisation. We report it, we take it as a reality. We're always talking about China and world trade and whatever else. Sometimes I think we may exaggerate quite how far it's gone. We are actually still very far apart, let us say, Europe and India. Our priorities are what really people are talking about in the streets. So we may exaggerate, but at least the perception is there's a great big threat out there going on while we're going through this chronic indigestion. Now, secondly, you argue that Europe needs a voice in the world. Here, I totally agree. It has a very distinctive voice, and it is a European voice. It's not a British voice, or a French voice, or a Belgian voice. There is a European voice. It's multilateral. It's about soft power more than hard power. When it comes to the military, it's about peacemaking, yes, but at the softer end, it's peacekeeping. We're not going to send 100,000 troops off anywhere in the world tomorrow. Robert Kagan, I think, is right. We are much more from Venus, and the Americans are much more from Mars. The difference between us is this. We do share the same values as America, but we don't agree about the means to achieve those values. And it's a very profound division between us, I think. Now, the UK and France are the two, you were polite enough not to name them, of course, who delude themselves that they still have a real global influence on their own. And that's part of the problem about the European common foreign policy. They do have a bigger global focus than any of the other countries in the European Union, including Germany. I think that's certainly true. But they delude themselves on what they can actually deliver at the end. And that, of course, we saw in Iraq. It was absolutely classic. They were the reason we couldn't have a debate. And yet neither of them achieved what they wanted. They both wanted the same thing. They wanted to prevent the Americans going into Iraq, let's be honest. The French tried to do it with hostility, and they failed. And the British tried to do it by sticking to them like glue, and they failed. So they both failed on their own, and it was a classic case where perhaps, just perhaps, if Europe had spoken with one voice, we might have actually stopped this lunatic project going ahead as it did. European foreign policy, and I think that very often in this city and in Paris we forget it, the small countries are very important to it and they give it a very special flavour. The neutral countries do too. They're very often the best peacekeepers, the people who've been engaged most in development strategies and so on. And that's a hugely important part of what Europe brings. So this is a very special flavour that I think is the strength of Europe. Now, you say and you worry that the post-war justification of Europe, the right justification in its time, no longer really rings true to the younger generation. It's not enough. And it's not enough partly because of everything we have achieved, isn't it? It's partly not enough precisely because the borders are now all open and students can go on Erasmus scholarships all over the European Union, although, sadly, the British students don't seem to be bothered to do it, and more come the other way. Congratulations. I wish more British students would go out and study in European universities. And so they take the achievements for granted, I think. Secondly, the newer member states, like the UK and Scandinavian countries, are in the unbelievers camp, and that's a problem. And thirdly, the new member states of the EU10 are, I think, undecided which camp they're in. So there you've got a problem, and that leads you to the conclusion that only core Europe can really take us forward. First, the five functions that you quite quickly put forward, but that you really see core Europe as dealing with. Economic and social policy, absolutely. Research and development, technology, really pushing out the frontiers of that. I'm not sure I entirely agree about how they do it, but clearly it's got to be a big issue where we cooperate. Justice and security, foreign affairs and defence. Those are your five, and they're all absolutely ones where European cooperation should go forward more closely. I would actually take the environment and energy security out of your category of research and development and technology and make it a sixth. I think it is separate from just the IT, you know, the front lines of. But that's a niggle, not a big argument. My only question is this. You emphasize very much, and this is where I think I'm coming to a problem with how we create core Europe if it's going to happen. You emphasize very much the need to protect the European social model. You give it capital letters, which in this country wouldn't be recognized. I remember a famous day when Margaret Thatcher was asking, it wasn't the social model, but the social partners. And I think it was a summit in London, and she said to her fellow summiteers, what are the social partners? And I think it was Ruud Lubbers from the Netherlands who said, well, Mrs. Thatcher, I think the social partners are a bit like you and me, and I think I know which ones the trade unions are. The European social model, that, yes, there is something in common we all have, although André Sapir from your own country has done, I think, interesting work in showing that there are different social models too. There's a degree of commonality. But actually what you're talking about still is creating a political institutional structure in Europe where we can have the economic debates. I don't think there's a clear common position where a certain social model and a certain economic model is going to be agreed. It's got to be a debating forum, more than that, a political forum, that we create. But the problem of saying, actually, core Europe has got to have a common social model brings us straight away to the problem of how you maintain the internal market with a core Europe and your outer Europe. Because I think that, given that the internal market is so central to what the European Union is about, it raises an immediate problem. And the problem is this. How, if you're going to have high standards in your core, high social standards, you're going to have tax harmonization in your core to a significant degree, those are two areas where the outer ring will almost certainly have lower standards. That's why they're staying in the outer ring. And so, on two fundamental levels, they're going to be, if you like, tax dumping and social dumping on the centre. Can you maintain a single market if you've got that degree of competition, unfair competition, as many would see it in the core, existing? So I'm not sure you can maintain the internal market as it is today. Second point about core Europe, is there the political will? There is a huge political crisis in France today about France and Europe. And I think that it's not just about Jacques Chirac, it's more. I heard a French minister very recently saying the problem in France is that the French people are now afraid of everything. You talked about fear. It's in France more than anything else. And France has gone very wobbly. And let's not forget, France has a very strong Gaullist tradition. And there are some people who think Nicolas Sarkozy is going to be the great liberal who reforms the French economy. He's a Gaullist. You know he's a Gaullist. I know he's a Gaullist, not a liberal. In fact, liberalism is probably as dirty a word in France as it is in America. So there's a real... there's a real problem, I think, in the will of the people. And the other country where I think there's a problem with will, and we will see it whether it's demonstrated in the elections just next month, is Italy. And so you've got two major contributing countries who are hesitant on this idea of core Europe. So again, I have a problem of worrying about how you'll deliver it. I can see totally the logic of core Europe, but it's getting there that's the problem. I actually see entirely the logic of leaving out Britain and the Scandinavian countries. I think that's pretty justified. We don't want to be in. I'm not sure if your organisation, what was it called, Prime Minister, your Organisation of European States?
Yeah.
A bit like the dear old Organisation of American States, I suppose. I would call it the Organisation of Second-Class European States, perhaps. They are deliberately opting to be slightly second-class citizens. Now, one problem that, I mean, and I think they do deliberately opt to be that, but it raises an immediate problem about two key aspects of your 5 points, and that's common foreign policy and European defence policy. Because certainly, as far as the British are concerned, they would be a very helpful partner there, and without them, common foreign policy and European defence policy is much weaker than it would be. And I think that's true of the Scandinavians as well. They bring a very special flavour to what I was saying earlier about a neutral tradition, a peacemaking tradition, an aid-related tradition. It would be a great loss to Europe to lose that from the core. I do see the advantage of bringing in future enlargement candidates, Turkey and Ukraine, for example, into this outer circle. It makes that much easier. It gives you a sort of a real waiting room instead of a rather uncomfortable stay-outside waiting room. So all of that. I think I better wind up, hadn't I? So very quickly, I am on the last page, so that's all right. I have every sympathy with what you want to do, but I'm not convinced that pragmatically we can get there. I think there is a danger in what you want to do, and it is this. It's a danger that in doing this you will create a new fortress Europe, a mentality that is protectionist, a mentality that wants to reinforce the old community preference, reinforce even the common agricultural policy. I'm not a total unbeliever in the common agricultural policy, unlike William, I think, who would destroy it tomorrow. I do have some sympathy in the idea of creating food security in Europe. I think in 20 years' time, we may say, hang on, we needed that food security. But I think that a core Europe handled the wrong way will encourage the wrong sort of instincts in this globalized world that we're in. It's got to show that it is dynamic and functional. Then it'll be attractive. But if it is just protectionist, it won't be attractive. How do we get from here to there? That's the great dilemma. And perhaps we can hear some more on that.
Thank you very much indeed. Now let's widen it up. If I'm allowed just a couple of passing comments. On the question of a European social model, 14 years ago I spent a weekend with a fairly large group of experts under the chairmanship of Jacques Delors debating the question, is there a single European social model? And at the end of the weekend, Jacques Delors, who was then president of the Commission, concluded that there is not a single European social model. There are a range of different European social models, and that we have somehow to cope with that within the European Union. Secondly, on this, in terms of who's doing research in it, I should certainly add that Anthony Giddens, a mild connection with the London School of Economics, and the European Policy Network are currently doing, I think, some very useful work on the question of European social models and how they are adapting northern, central, and southern social models. And now let's throw it open to the floor. Let's take three or four questions at once, and then I'll invite you two to comment. Could I ask you all to, even if I know who you are, to say who you are and where you come from, whether from the LSE or somewhere else, as you start. And I think there are microphones. Good. To Donald Anderson here on the front row.
Quentin's last question, how do
Donald
we get...
Donald Anderson, House of Lords. Sorry, you were going to say.
Quentin's last question, how do we get from here to there? I suppose the question is put, where is there, and do we want to get there? That I didn't detect any notion of subsidiarity in the proposals put forward by the Prime Minister, that in terms of European identity, look at Spain, for example, Catalonia is increasingly the identity there, Wales and Scotland seeking greater powers in the UK, that Europe, as we define ourselves, is as much a diversity and a proud diversity as a concentration. And the more that we seek to have cause, the less perhaps we will forget that part, which is very dear to most of us Europeans, another identity, and the need to have as much Europe as necessary, but as much subsidiarity as possible.
Let's take two or three more. Let's take your... Yes, sorry. I saw you first.
Mr. Phil has concluded his remarks.
Sorry, you are from?
I am from the Federalist Trust. My name is Raphael Papadopoulos.
Okay.
Mr. Phil has concluded his remarks by saying that he has every sympathy with the Prime Minister's ideas, but he expressed doubts of whether we can get there. Now, he said at the beginning that he is going to approach the subject in an Anglo-Saxon way, and he lives up to this. Because I want to remind him that in this newspaper, which I read, and he knows it very well, 6 months before the launch of the euro, half of the commentators were foreseeing that the euro will not happen.
Okay. Let's take one from the other side.
There's only 50%. That's a good record.
I was going to take the one at the back. So I couldn't, there's a hand up. I couldn't quite see which one it was. Okay. Sorry.
Robert McLennan, House of Lords, member of the Convention on the Future of Europe. You spoke, Prime Minister, of the desire, of the need for convergence, not harmonization. But do you see, in speaking of the economic integration, do you see that as being backed by union law? And if so, how can there be uniform law with 25 member states which do not distort unacceptably the economies of the members?
And one more, just this at the back here, and then we'll return to the panel.
Hi, Tom Claret, LSE student from Belgium. Well, there seems to be a pretty important difference between the United States of America and those of Europe, which is that the American executive is accountable to the voters by being elected and accountable to the legislative branch through checks and balances, whereas the European executive, European Commission, is not elected and is virtually unaccountable to the European Parliament. Moreover, it seems that the more power the European Parliament obtains, the more it actually blocks liberalizing proposals, the Services Bill, the Port Directive. So it seems to be, can Europe be made more democratic while not undermining the four fundamental freedoms that Europe is supposed to be standing for? Thank you.
Maybe I can start with the question about what I think the most important is also my response to what Mr. Peel said about convergence. Like I said also in the little book, I don't believe in harmonization just because this diversity that exists inside the European Union. I try to harmonizing everything, fiscal matters, security matters, is impossible. There doesn't exist really one European social model. There is an approach in Europe about social security matters, that's true, but there is no one model that exists in different countries. But nevertheless, I think that what we need is not harmonization, but convergence. Convergence for me means that with the countries of the European Union, at least with the countries of the Eurozone, we are defining maximum and minimum values. Maximum values are necessary inside the European Union to guarantee the competitivity of the European economy. And the minimum values are necessary to avoid the social dumping inside the European Union. So what I'm proposing is that the different economies inside the European Union, at least in the Eurozone, are developing themselves on a track that with borders, maximum and minimum borders, who are in fact representing the competitivity at one side and to abolish social dumping at the other side. Because diversity is so important inside the European Union that it's impossible to say that is one tax regime for the 25 countries of the 12 countries of the Eurozone. That's totally stupid to do so. But we need at least minimum and maximum values so that different economies of the European Union are developing themselves in the same direction with the same philosophy behind their reforms on the labor market, on industrial policy, on tax reforms, and so on. I give one example. One of the problems for the moment of the European economy, who has a lower growth rate than in the US and then in Southeast Asia, is that for the moment we have a very high tax regime on labor forces. That is a widespread problem with all tax systems inside the European Union. What we are doing, in fact, is we are exporting our jobs for the moment, not our products, because of the high tax on labor. So a common strategy inside the European Union, or at least inside the Eurozone, could be to say, okay, let's transfer taxation systems on labor to other taxation. Taxation on environment, taxation on consumer goods. I shall not use taxation on capital because it's against the program of my party. taxation on other production factors that we know in our society. So that we need, but that is a global strategy to do. It's not a country like Belgium with open borders that tomorrow can decide, okay, we shall change the structure of our tax system. You have to do that with the different neighbors. We have to do that in a common strategy. So when I'm talking about a common policy, I'm not talking about harmonization. It's very clear. I'm talking about convergence policy. In fact, what I find is that within the Lisbon strategy, we don't have any method. The open coordination method is no method. It's benchmarking and peer review. It's comparing ourselves with each other. We don't need to compare ourselves with each other. We have to compare us with the US. We have to compare us with India, Japan, and so on. They are the new competitors worldwide. So what we need is a common strategy to these new heavyweights in the future, and not benchmarking, peer review, national reports on reforms. No, we need a more important and more deepened method. So the second thing that I want to say is about subsidiarity. I launched a little bit the whole debate about subsidiarity in the Declaration of Laeken, and there for the first time we have described a subsidiarity test, who was later on put into the result of the convention. So the convention, based on the Declaration of Laeken, had taken the subsidiarity test as one of the possibilities to deal with this problem. Because what is the problem? Is to say, what is the competence of the Union, European Union, what is the competence of the national states and of the regions? So you have two possibilities then. You describe the different competences inside your constitution, who are Union competences, European level, and then the competences for the national state and for the regions. We didn't do that at the end because it was too difficult, so the convention decided to repeat what was suggested in the Declaration of Laeken and to have a subsidiarity test. So I'm in favor of a subsidiarity test. I don't think that we need with the European Union to deal with every problem. Like, for example, an example that I'm always giving is the directive on opening hours inside the European Union, a stupidity, because in Finland it's already night at the moment that a shop in Italy is opening at 4 o'clock or at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So to have a directing of opening hours of shops is not a competence for the European Union, like other things on education, on culture, are not competence for the European Union. So what I'm proposing on subsidiarity is that we need subsidiarity. If we have to hold something from the Constitution, in certainly the subsidiarity test, but certainly also other topics. So that are my two remarks to the questions that have been put forward. Mr. Peel have also said, yes, he talked about France and Italy, but on Italy I'm going there the 3rd of March this month to present the Italian version with an introduction of Romano Prodi and Giuliano Amato on the ideas. And I agree with him that what's happening for the moment in France, what's happening for the moment in Italy, is affecting a lot the whole course of the European debate for this moment. So that's my two, three remarks to the questions.
Can I just pick up one of the points anyway? The gentleman at the back who talked about the difference between the United States of Europe and the United States of America, that the Commission is not elected. Yes, that's clearly the case at the moment. In fact, it's worse than unelected. Half the governments of Europe send their tiredest and most pensioned-off politicians to be commissioners. So it is actually a pretty disastrous system that we have at the moment. Nonetheless, I think we are steadily moving towards a system where the Commission is more accountable and more elected, whether it will be through the European Parliament or what. And I would certainly argue very much with your perception that the Commission is not accountable to the European Parliament. And I would put it in the words of one of the commissioners who was saying to me, the difference between being finance minister in my own country and being a commissioner in Brussels is quite extraordinary. In my own country, when I'm finance minister, we have the party whip system. I do not have to bother. If I put up an unpopular proposal, I know my party will be forced to back it. I therefore don't have to work. I have to go down to the European Parliament almost every day of the week to campaign for what I'm proposing in the European Commission. I have to try and get coalitions together to support it. I have to go around all the groups. I really have to work to get the European Parliament on side. And actually, this is one of the extraordinary misperceptions, I think, very strong in this country, that we think our national politics are more responsive than actually European political process. The European political process is giving us a lot of democratic lessons, and we're not looking.
That's a very good comment. Let me take four more questions. And I'm particularly looking for students if I find them, so I'll take the student with the red jumper on over there.
Hi, I'm Cedric Ida. I'm a Belgian student here.
I promised the Prime Minister there'd be one or two Belgian students being awkward.
Mr. Prime Minister, what is your attitude towards what we're seeing in Europe today in the mergers and acquisitions field and the protectionist attitude of, a few countries in Europe towards these processes?
Thank you. And one of... Yes.
Thank you, Prime Minister. You're coming from a country in which which is formerly trilingual, if I'm not mistaken. I'm an LSE student from Holland, actually. In which the language battle or division between mainly the French-speaking and the Dutch-speaking groups have often caused problems at all kinds of levels in government when it comes to cooperation and cohesion. In an increasingly linguistically diverse Europe, how would you deal with this? How do you think Europe should deal with this kind of linguistic diversity at both the government level and in creating something like a European civil society, a sort of European cohesion in your model of a United States of Europe? Thank you.
Thank you. Tim. Van Rijn.
Timothy Garton-Ash, Oxford, still a student at heart. Two questions, Prime Minister, prompted by your very stimulating manifesto. Firstly, you make a compelling plea for European foreign policy going well beyond the frontiers of Europe. What should we do immediately about a situation on our own continent, in a European country, in Belarus, where we've just seen an election that was clearly not free and fair, where European monitors have said there was massive intimidation, and where protesters are waving the flags of the European Union and looking to us for a response? That's the immediate question. The larger question follows Quentin's questioning of your fundamental model. The key premise of your argument is that the circles would be concentric, the hardcore of the United States of Europe and the outer circle of the Organization of European States. What grounds do you have for believing that the circles would be concentric and not polycentric? That is to say that the larger and smaller states not in the core group would form a countervailing alliance, which is what has happened for most of European history until the early 1950s. Now, you may say for 40 years from the early 1950s to the early 1990s, the laggards like Britain always did come on board in the end. But before the 1950s, for hundreds of years, that was not the case. And since the early 1990s, we have again seen the politics of polycentric circles, for example, over Iraq. So what makes you confident that they would be concentric?
Thanks. I can see about 15 people who want to ask questions. I just promised, since the microphone has just gone upstairs, let me take one from upstairs, and then we'll carry on.
Linda Corsha, LSE. You referred to people's concerns, but it seems to me that you did nothing to actually address them. In regard, to come back to the democratic deficit, and particularly in relation to the secretive trade commitments that the Commission makes without reference to member state parliaments. You've referred, for instance, to people's concerns about labour, free movement of labour within the EU, but the trade commitments currently on the table actually open up the labour market to the rest of the world as well, even if people don't realise it. So do you have any I'm talking about mode four of GATS. Do you have any comment on this in relation to people's concerns that you have referred to but haven't addressed?
Maybe Mr. Chair, I can start with the question and the remark of Timothy Gordon Ash about concentric and concentric circles. I think when we look to the history of the European Union, that we have the successes, and one of the biggest successes is certainly the creation of a single currency. A single currency was created with initially with 12 member states based on the Stability Pact, and there we have a good example of an enhanced cooperation, because it was not an official body, it's not an official body of institution of the European Union, the Eurozone, the Eurogroup. It's an enhanced cooperation of a number of countries who want to deal together a number of monetary issues. And what we see is that it's working like a concentric circle, because on the 1st of January 2007, a new country shall enter, Slovenia, inside the Eurozone. And it's very clear that in the next 2-3 years, most of the new member states, once they fulfill the different conditions of the Stability Pact, shall enter in this circle, concentric circle of the Eurozone. So there we have a good example of an enhanced cooperation, of a circle inside the European Union that is in fact working well. The only problem is, and that is my plea today, is that we need also inside this zone, growing zone, an economic, common economic and social strategy, because it's totally unthinkable that you have a single currency, you have a monetary union, but you have no common economic strategy. It's like in the US, you have your dollar, you have the Federal Reserve Board, and then more than 50 different economic policies, different state by state in the US. It is unthinkable, but it's reality in Europe for the moment. It's the reason why it is necessary to go on with the Eurozone is to fulfill the conditions for the success of this concentric circle of the Eurozone. And the fact that a number of countries, new countries that were new, are totally new in the European Union, are now knocking on the door to the Eurozone is, for me, a good example that at the end, people want to join this combination, want to join this cooperation that we have. Naturally, and that's my second point, to have a better cooperation and to have concentric circles were growing, you need certainly a number of instruments. For example, in the foreign policy, I don't believe in the European foreign policy if we don't have two things, the European diplomacy, European defense, and European army. It's totally unthinkable that to think to have a common foreign policy if you have not one common instrument. It's only because you have one common instrument that you're obliged to have one common position. If at a certain moment we have a crisis like in Iraq, and we have not European battle groups on paper, but a real European army with common equipment that can be active outside the European borders, and you have one European diplomacy, for example, with a common representation in multilateral organizations, then you are obliged to have one common foreign policy. Then it's not longer possible to say, like we did on Iraq, no, we have different point of views, it's not necessary to talk about it. Let's go to the confrontation between us in the UN. And so I believe in any way that when you look to the history, there are two lessons. First of all, concentric circles, enhanced cooperation within a limited group is working. Secondly, what is a bad thing What I fear is to multiply the different circles. I don't believe in a European Union with different circles. The Eurozone with 12 member states, Schengen with other members, another cooperation on another field, again with other member states. At the end, people, the public opinion, is seeing a European Union with different combinations, where, for example, those who are outside the Eurozone are criticizing the Eurozone, and vice versa. And then we ask that the public opinion is positive towards the European Union. So what we need is certainly a concentric circle, but always the same group. Maybe there's one exception. That's on European defense, certainly, because that European defense, you need the biggest, the strongest alliance possible also inside your European organization. And there, I think, we have to go beyond only the 12 or tomorrow the 30 member states of the Eurozone. The second thing about protectionism, I'm very much against protectionism, and I think that against this, some are saying, wave of protectionism that we are feeling today inside the European Union in a number of matters, for example, in energy and so on, we have a number of instruments. So the first thing I did, at the moment that Gaz de France and CWS was announcing their cooperation, creating an enormous big energy company on the continent, was to invite Mrs. Cruz, the European Commissioner for Competition, to see with her what are the different possibilities to create, after the fusion, again, enough competition on the Belgian market. Because the reality and the consequence of this new company, the Suez Gaz de France, is that 90% of the electricity production in Belgium and 90% of the gas import in Belgium is in the hand of one company. So I don't think that's that you can say there is enough and a fair competition. So the first thing I did was to ask Ms. Cruz to analyze the situation, not only the situation on the European market, but also on the regional Belgium market, and to take a number of initiative measures. We shall start ourselves a negotiation with Suez Gaz de France to avoid protectionism and create enough competition on the Belgian market. But I think we have enough instruments for that. The directives, the different regulations on concentration inside the European Union are plenty of regulation of instruments to avoid protectionism. So, third, on the question of the languages, I'm always saying I think Belgium is a good example of this problem, how to combine and how to work in a country with different communities, with different regions, with different languages. In fact, I'm always saying we have three official languages, in fact four. There is also English, I think, but beyond that, Dutch, French, and German, official languages in Belgium, three communities, three regions. And maybe people are saying, well, it's very complicated there, the federal state you have created. Okay, maybe it's complicated, but the results are that we have made from a unitary state a federal state without any casualties, with I think, a good result, a peaceful situation, a stability inside the country. And you could say that a little bit Belgium is like a laboratory for the European Union, where you have the combination of different communities on the border of the north of Europe and Latin, the Latin part of Europe. And it's certainly something that we have to safeguard inside the European Union. Some people are saying why it's necessary to use all these languages in the European Council, in all these meetings. I think it's absolutely necessary to continue with that. Maybe one exception on that. That's the European patent, where I hope like everybody, every researcher is using English for his research, that we could create a European patent as fast as possible without this question on have we to translate everything in 5, 10, even more languages, and with this consequence that it costs more, three times more European patent in Europe than the other side of the Atlantic. There was also a question on Belarus. I think what we have to do is to increase now our measures to that to Belarus. And to continue to take measures to help them. We started a number of sanctions. There is no longer meetings between political leaders in Europe and the political leadership in Belarus. We have not only to continue with that, we have to intensify that, because it's very clear that only pressure of the international community, and especially of the 25 in a good coordination of the European Union, can maybe change something in that country and can break up this lack of democracy that exists in that country.
Thank you. Well, good. I think we have time for one more round. Laurence, you've been waiting a long time. There's a...
Laurence Froelich, Federal Union. The core Europe idea, does this not create a danger of making the people outside the core into second-class citizens and making us out here in the outer darkness of, on this offshore island even more detached from the sense of being part of the European scene?
May I respond directly to that?
Okay.
Because I find it a very... Otherwise, when there are four or five questions, maybe I forget it at the end, because I find it the most important question on the proposal. The Eurozone and Eurogroup is an open group. Everybody can enter. Everybody who wishes enters. The only question and the only thing to fulfill are the conditions of the Stability Pact. And the fact that it works, I give you the example of Belgium. Belgium was the baddest country with the baddest public finances of the whole European Union. When I started in my political life as Minister of the Budget, I know nothing about mathematics, but that's not necessary to be Minister of the Budget. The only thing you have to know is the word no, as you are Minister of the Budget. Well, we got a public debt of 136% of GDP and a fiscal deficit of 16% for the global government, all authorities together, and only for the federal government 12.7%. So I shall never forget these figures when you start as Minister of the Budget. So it is because of the Stability Pact of the Eurozone that we accepted voluntarily that we have now 7 years in a row a balanced budget, that we have lowered our public debt from 136 to 90% of GDP. And maybe it's also one of the reasons that we have a little bit more economic growth the last 4 years than the average in the Eurozone. But let me come back to the beginning of my story. It's an open group. It's an open club. If you fulfill the conditions, you enter. Slovenia shall enter on the 1st of January 2007. It's very clear that the number of Baltic states shall enter, I don't know, in 2007, 2008. And what are other advantages of this proposal? The Netherlands and France are already member of the club, so you don't need a new referendum to start with the whole thing.
But
that was tactical more than last referendum.
But actually, your proposal, though, for a core Europe is to raise the barrier. It's not just going to be the Stability Pact. And there are an awful lot of people out there who want to join.
Yeah, but the reason, the new conditions that you shall put are conditions to start reforms in the country. I don't want to make new barriers to make it more difficult. No, what I want is that this economic governance inside the Eurozone is creating reforms in every country member of the Eurozone. Not the same reforms, identical reforms, but reforms going in the same direction. That's what I'm called convergence, with this minimum and this maximum values. So that, because we are affected today by a lack of reform, for example, in other countries. There was a meeting in Hampton Court, and the representative of the Italian government said in Hampton Court, yes, with the Eurozone, there are many problems. It was far more easier in the past when we did the devaluation of the lira to be competitive. But that's no longer the reality. In the Eurozone, a lack of reforms in one country is affecting the situation in another country. So and we need a common strategy on the reforms in the labor market, on the reforms in industrial policy, reforms on... Otherwise, it is impossible to go on a long-term basis further with one currency, with a single currency, and with one monetary union. And I think also it's maybe the only possibility. Like the Stability Pact forces the Belgian government to do what at some time it was unthinkable. If I'm going to the parliament with €1 of deficit now, I'm killed in the parliament. So it becomes a myth, this balanced budget. but it's because of the Stability Pact. So, like the Stability Pact created an engine to solve the public finance, the worst public finance of the whole Europe in Belgium, so I think a real economic governance can be the engine for real economic reforms on the continent, in a number of countries of the Eurozone. And reforms were going in the same direction, even when they are not identical, because there's diversity that exists in Europe.
I think we must now have a maximum of two questions, because we need to pull this to a close. But I see, I think, John, you're one of the founders of the Federal Trust?
Yes.
John Pinder.
Publish your book.
Thank you.
And we're very keen on that. I should say that the Federal Trust was founded by an enlightened group of people, which included Lord Beveridge, William Beveridge, who I think was the grandfather of the social orientation, at least, of all our European countries, and also was the director of this school, which took it from being a night classes for Londoners to being one of the greatest social science institutions in the world. And he was a Federalist and one of the founders of the Federal Trust, I say. So I have observed, since you were 2 years old, actually, the federal development of the European Union, which has got halfway. It's not enough. I agree. I empathize with you exactly as Quentin Peel did. And my question would be this one. It's based on the observation that the Brits, after the war, came out of it feeling good, and the Continentals came out of it feeling bad. And that has been fundamental to the differing attitudes towards the European integration and federal development, because peace in Europe was absolutely fundamental drive for everybody inside the six member states. And the Brits didn't feel this. Now, I do think that peace in the world, or security in the world, is the great motive power. It's something that could change the British. Seeing that the EU is the great hope for a world system that is decent and moving in the same direction as the Europeans moved. And so I think that could bring the Brits round. But from what you said, perhaps it also is what can enthuse younger people, because peace in Europe is a given for them. And do you not think that your last two things, the foreign policy and the defence, are absolutely fundamental to creating a Europe that has the ability to get real enthusiasm from all generations?
Last question from the young woman behind.
You were talking about enlargement. Irina Iordachescu, Richmond University, Romanian. You were talking about enlargement before and about convergence, and you were talking about the spectrum from minimum values to maximum values. Yeah. My question is, when it comes to enlargement, it seems as if the European Commission comes with a strategy of its own, and the strategy seems to be towards liberalization. It follows a specific model, liberalization, labor market flexibility. This kind of clashes to a certain extent with Fortress Europe, with all Europe. How are you going to do the convergence? And isn't there a clash between centripetal and centrifugal forces inside Europe?
I think that just because there is this opposition and antagonism between deepening and enlargement, that we need a new vision and a new story based, I think, like I propose it, on the Eurozone. Because I don't want to make a choice between both of them. I think that we need to continue with enlargement of the European Union. The enlargement of the European Union is the basic principle for peace and stability on the European continent. And we have not finished the job. Those who are now working on the Balkans know that next month, maybe next year, there can be again violence, war, civil war. Everything what happened in Serbia-Montenegro for the moment, the political talks on Kosovo. The only good solution for the Balkans is to put all the Balkan countries inside the European Union, inside the European family. after Romania and after Bulgaria, certainly, but nevertheless, in the European Union and in the European family, and because this is the best way to stabilize. And so we shall certainly see a European Union becoming bigger and bigger, now 25, then 27, after the entrance of Balkan countries, more than 30, 32, maybe 35, I don't know. But in any way, if you want then also a European Union that can deliver on a number of economic issues, you need not only enlargement, and to continue this enlargement, you need also this deepening. And deepening is only possible when you enlarge at the same time with a limited number of countries. But always in an open mind, always with the possibility that those who are entering in your European Union can also enter later on when they fulfill a number of conditions in your core group, in your Eurozone group of what you call it. And I agree with the previous remark that was done on the necessity that with the enlargement and with our way of thinking, with a common foreign policy, we can really be an engine for peace building worldwide. But let's start maybe in our own, on our own continent, where there are still a lot of things to do, and there the only answer is enlarge, enlarge, and continue to enlarge.
Prime Minister, I'd like to thank you very much indeed. We have been officially in a period of reflection on the future of the European Union for the last 9 months. It's largely been a process of silence for most member governments, and I'm very glad to know that the Belgian government, at least led by you as Prime Minister, is concerned that we shall debate all of these issues. There are very many, many more questions that we need to debate, certainly about the balance between core Europe and which core Europe, and a wider Europe, and how far wider the wider Europe goes. But for the moment, I'd like to thank you very much indeed. I hope you found it valuable to come to the London School of Economics, which is, I should underline, a much more European institution than most universities on the European continent. And we look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.